Welcome to MCBI's 60 Mock, a podcast for curious thinkers.
Welcome, listeners. It's Marina from MCBI, and we're continuing the 60 Mock podcast adventure with interviewing some fantastic South Australian leaders. And I'm very, very appreciative to be sitting opposite Nigel McBride, the Chief Executive Officer of Business SA. And so welcome, Nigel.
Marina, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Welcome to the basement.
It's what a fantastic studio this is. I had no idea it existed, and more people have got to get on down here.
Absolutely. It is. It's a tremendous, yeah, a whole lot of fantastic little facilities around in this building.
It's what I've described at the Paris leafy end of Featherstone Alley. Oh, it's not alley, it's
no,
a place.
But it is an alley, let's be honest.
But it's at the leafy end, if you're looking for the
leafy,
yeah.
The Paris end the Paris of the end. Drug alley. Yeah,
exactly. Where the price of heroin goes up a little because it's leafy.
That's right. What I'm saying. It is. It's all about packaging.
Yes, indeed.
All right. So we've got about 10 to 12 minutes to get to know a bit about you and to get some of the information and the experiences that you've gleaned over the years and be able to package it up and impart it to our listeners. So before we do anything else, can you please share with us just a little bit about how on earth you got to be here today and some of your professional background?
Yes, well, it's I'll try and keep it short, Marina.
I know, it'll take a while.
It's hard, isn't it? Yeah. I was an Air Force brat from the RAF. So my dad was an engineer in the RAF. And I was born on an RAF base in Wiltshire, more than 20 years ago.
Wow.
And moved around the world, West Africa, Northern Ireland. My mother's Northern Irish. I suppose we should say just Irish now. We ended up emigrating to New Zealand as a family. I went to Canterbury University and did science and law. Ended up doing all kinds of weird things when I graduated. I was broke, just married. So I ended up working for two big pharmaceutical companies in sales.
Fantastic.
And I had wonderful life lessons. Like you walk into a busy doctor and he or she has just met the one person in their day, their terrible day that they don't have to be nice to. And so it taught me how to walk in and in 5 minutes sell an obscure, not a product on the table, but I had to sell a concept that they'd start to prescribe my drug, my antihypertensive as it was at the time. And as a young man who'd just graduated, it was a crucible experience. But I've taken that with me for the rest of my life because I'll never be intimidated. I can walk in to see a premier, walk into a board meeting, I can walk into an auditorium. And those first few years of understanding how you've got to walk into a room, talk to somebody who doesn't actually want to hear from you, overcome their, quite often their aggression and their bad temperedness, and with a smile convince them to do something that actually when you walked in they didn't want to do. And I found that that's an incredible gift that those early years gave me in being able to be just fearless about communicating and about not worrying about what people are thinking at the time but getting something through. And I was proud to have the highest market penetration of that drug in my territory in the country because I simply learned to walk in and understand that those people needed for me to get on with it and get out, but to do it in a way that I could change them. And all you could do was ask them to change. And you didn't know until later whether they gave it a go. But what you did learn is to ask for the business. And in all of my years, whether running large law firms or being involved in the private sector or the not-for-profit sector or the public sector, there's a real problem. People don't ask for the business. People will skirt around. It's like a bad date where, you know, your fingers just kind of touch and, you know, you skirt around. This is probably a terrible metaphor, but, you know.
I'm interested to see where it's going to go.
But, you know, people don't ask for the business. People don't have the courage to be rejected.
Like in a bad date.
Yeah, like in a bad date. Like somebody says, no, you don't look like your photo. You're not getting it. But it's kind of, it's one of those important things and it ties up with the fear of rejection. You've got to be able to ask for the business and therefore you've got to understand that rejection's going to be part of your life and it's part of business, it's part of asking. And just those early crucible years of being able to sell and communicate were very kind of informative and kind of influential in the rest of my career choices going forward.
So now you're the Chief Executive Officer of Business SA.
Yes.
You know, leading the charge in terms of being an industry voice and what South Australia needs. Tell us about that role.
Well, it's a role that takes a great deal of courage because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what the government of the day is or who they are, federal, state or local, they're probably not going to do enough for the business community or the employer community that you'd like them to. So by definition, you, without fear or favour, praise governments who you believe do the right thing. But without fear or favour, you've also got to challenge them and say, well, you're not doing enough, or that's a bad policy, or that's an unnecessary tax, or it's a tax that's too high. And, you know, while we are not apolitical, we're highly political because we're involved in the political process, we're nonpartisan. And sometimes people don't understand the difference. If I said we were apolitical, it would mean that we'd sit in a dark room, form policy, hold hands and sing Kumbaya and nothing would happen.
And you don't do that?
We can't do that. You've got to actually, you've probably heard rumours about Kumbaya, Marina, but no, we don't actually do that. I just want to your listeners, I want to quash that. But what we do is we form policy and we go out and advocate them, and we have to do that with politicians, we have to do that in the media. So to influence change, we have to be incredibly forward in terms of courageously raising issues that sometimes are uncomfortable. Mm. Last financial year, we had a media footprint of over $5 million in value.
Yeah.
And we have that because we've got credibility with the media, that we play with a straight bat, that we're not an arm of any political party, that we are committed to building this economy through the business and employer sector, mainly in the state, 98% of whom are small to medium-sized enterprises. And so when the former premier, the last premier, called those people an employer class in a fairly disparaging way, we have to stand up and say, you're wrong, and you've got that. That's a completely inappropriate way of seeing small business providing jobs for your kids in the state. So it is a courageous role. We have to be prepared to say things that other people can't afford to say in a small town with big government.
Yeah.
And we'll continue to do that. So it's really interesting. We're as much a media organisation as we are a membership organisation or a services organisation to try and help small to medium-sized enterprises mainly. And we've learned influence is something that's very hard won, and trust in the media is really hard won. And it doesn't take long if you're seen to be inconsistent that you'll lose credibility.
So just a question, like, do you enjoy it?
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I think it's not a question. Probably enjoy is not the right term. I think do I find it fulfilling when we get a message through? I find it really fulfilling.
Yeah.
The flip side of that coin is when I get a soundbite that's clipped out, that's wrong, that television cuts, you know, the things I really wanted to say, and they grab that 1 4-second soundbite that's out of context, you find it incredibly frustrating. So the continuum is from enormously fulfilling to win something like the bank tax campaign, to actually run a campaign that stopped a bad tax that was going to hurt our brand, it was going to hurt employment, it was going to hurt our economy. You know, talking to investment bankers in London who were going to downgrade our credit rating and Australia's credit rating because of this sovereign risk, to actually get an outcome where that tax was abandoned is enormously fulfilling. But quite often we chip away at the rock of policy, and it's very frustrating. And so it's a bit of a long game.
Yeah, it is. And I think you and I have had chats over this little while, you know, drunken ones and passionate ones and despondent ones. And it's always struck me that this sense of duty and this sense of purpose that you demonstrate in this role, and I think it's one of these roles in leadership where it comes through, probably more than many, actually. It's almost there's this real sense of I've got to do this.
Yeah, I mean that's a thank you for that. That's very kind of you to say. From my point of view, our mission, our purpose is to grow the economy of South Australia, and that means we will, you know, we're for growth. We want to see growth in jobs, the economy, investment, new business, and we'll attack anything, we'll challenge anything that we believe undermines growth. So it's a very clear mission and purpose. It isn't always popular. In fact, quite often we're not here to be liked, we're here to be respected. And I think we've gained a lot of respect. We went to the last state election with a campaign, a call to action to all parties about losing our best and brightest young people.
Yes.
The fact that we've had 15 years of no net interstate migration growth. And that's a call to action. That's an urgent situation. And we're glad that ad had a cut through and had an impact in every sense.
Yeah, good for you for standing up. You know, more people need to stand up for something. Quite often just the energy of standing up will cause others to make a position themselves. So you've talked about this crucible period of your life when you learnt sales, and don't we all learn the power of rejection? But was there any other significant moment in your career that you felt really changed you, for good or for bad? Something that really sent you in a new direction.
Yeah, that's a great question. Look, I came to Adelaide to take a law firm that was a large law firm that was the bottom of the pile, a very old law firm that I was asked to come by the national firm to come and turn around. I thought I'd be here for a very short time, you know, on the way to somewhere.
Yeah.
Ended up falling in love with Adelaide. I spent 12 years building that firm. But within 5 or 6, we'd taken it to the top of the market.
How did you do that?
Well, it was all about people. So
it's a good slogan.
It's
our slogan.
Maybe I saw that upstairs. I'm not sure, but you know, I think I had the T-shirt first. But I came in and Adelaide in that era. So I came in 2000. Reminded me of an old boys rowing club. You know,
okay, yeah.
You had A rows, B rows, C rows, and D rows, and they were all in every boat.
Yeah.
And so everybody was mediocre. And nothing had changed for years in the legal scene. Everybody was really complacent. They had their clients, et cetera. And so I came in and said, well, I don't care what school you went to. I don't care if you go to – nothing wrong with the Adelaide Club, but I don't want to join, and I don't care if you are a member. I want the best people. And so I went about going out and finding the A-team. So I kicked my C and D rowers out of the boat. Sort of half the firm went in the first 3 years.
Wow.
It was hard, but you know, if you want to go somewhere, you've got to make hard decisions.
Yeah.
And then that gave me the ability to go out and pick up the best out there in the market, and I went out and I targeted who we saw as the best players.
Mm.
And so within a very short time, we started to grow. And I said to my partners, you're either boutique or you dominate the market. If you get caught in the middle, you're in trouble because it's such a small market. So I decided we would be the biggest and most dominant commercial law firm in the market, and I set out to do it. We did it in 5 or 6 years. What surprised me, most of all, on this double-digit compound revenue growth year after year in a small town, was the lack of pushback. So one of the things I did was I bought in some case management technology from the UK. I used it notoriously to win probably the largest legal services contract, which was the WorkCover defendant contract. We replaced, I think, eight law firms to do it.
Wow.
We convinced the government to change the whole approach from a Dickensian count the pages type approach to billing to an outcome-based. I think we saved them 60% of their annual costs. And we became the sole provider, and one of the most extraordinarily successful stories of using technology and driving efficiency, not being paid for inefficiency like lawyers do. Mm. You know, the more hours you put in, the more inefficient you are, the more pages you count, all of that sort of scale costing stuff was incredibly inefficient. And so we turned it on its head. And even by saving the employers in the state probably at least 60% in defendant legal costs, we still made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it shows you the waste, the inefficiency that can grow up in complacency.
It's interesting. You say that the technology helped the solution, which it certainly is an enabler. It's something our listeners are really interested in, the role of technology. But I would suggest that it was actually your vision that actually pushed it forward, and then everyone else sort of followed this imagination that you're able to articulate.
Yes.
And then technology just became a natural part of that story.
It was really interesting because I put in a non-complying tender. Yep. I said, we'll do it all for this amount. The people on the other side of the table just about fell off their chairs. The treasurer at the time, Kevin Foley, rang me at home on the weekend and said, are you serious? Can you do it for this? And I said, Kevin, you know, what I've got to tell you is that if we can't do it for it, it's our problem, not yours. So, you know, make the decision, you know. And he said, yeah, that's great, we'll back it. But I had proved that technology, and this is another interesting story about not taking no for an answer. Maybe that's part of my Crucible experience. Mm. So we tried to get onto the medical negligence panel for the health department here. Well, basically people had to die. Yeah, people had to die or be run over by a truck for us to get a slot on the panel as lawyers. So I said, righto, well, we'll go after the risk management slot. And so we replaced Aon as risk managers. And they said, lawyers can't do risk management. I said, sure we can.
We can do anything.
Yeah, I came from a risk management background. Why wouldn't we do it? And we had we brought in this case management technology before, so we tried it with medical negligence cases. The sharp decline in costs and the shortening of outcomes was just dramatic, absolutely dramatic. And we just took a whole different approach. Instead of the passive, complacent, let's do it the same old way, we went and replaced one of the world's biggest, risk managers, and blew the socks off the stats. Mm. And so I knew when I came to what was a much bigger gig, the case management technology worked, our approach of getting the settings right and the outcomes right worked, and it gave some confidence. But yeah, it was scary. There was a few sweaty palm moments there, but frankly, you know, 20s of millions of dollars in revenue later over the next, 8 to 10 years have been extraordinary.
It's funny listening to you and how effortlessly you described that, you know, if as a consultant, you know, we're analysing all the time, that this insight you have where you can actually look at how people work and then figure out better ways to do it is such a rare thing. People do get stuck in, this is how we've always done it. And for you to have that flexibility to be able to jump around and go, let's try something else, is not only an amazing use of creativity, but also the tenacity to go and the boldness to go, no, we're going to take the imagination and give it a go on it. And the other thing I'd like to just roll back to is a little part of leadership which is often not discussed, and it is the part where you evaluate the team or your followers and you classify them.
Yes.
And we all know that A graders like playing with other A graders, and now and then they'll be happy to play with a B grader, and the B graders like hanging out with other B, but they aspire to be A graders. But when you've got a team composition that has C and D graders, a leader needs to understand that and put a cap on the energy to allow someone to go up the chain or not. There's no magic. There's no magic to that.
So I've turned around some large organisations, and I say to people, there is no hidden agenda. My agenda is that A-grade people, by whatever name,
people who work hard, match to their job,
who care about this, deserve to work with other people who feel the same way, put in the same effort, and are on the same bus.
Yeah.
I said everybody else deserves to stand in front of the bus. And so, you know.
Maybe it's that last part.
Yeah. It's kind of like, get on the bus, understand the vision,
we're going to drive over you.
Or you're probably, by definition, going to be in front of the bus. And so I used to say that. Now, what happened is when you say that and you say what you're looking for, so you don't talk about what you're not looking for. You say, I need people who are A, B, C, D, and E. If you're one of those and you want to be one of those, get on board, let's go for it. If you're not, we're going to have a problem. The first thing that happened is so many people started to self-select. I didn't have to tap everybody on the shoulder. People said, oh, okay, well, if that's where it's going, that's not me. And I used to say to people, I don't expect you to necessarily want to do this. I release you from any sense. You know, if you came to me and said, I don't want to do it, great, fantastic, go and do something you want to do. I remember this awful thing where a lady who'd been with a law firm in Perth that I was running had been with us for 30 years. She was a vicious gossip and very unhappy woman, and I was sacking her this day. And as I told her the good news, she absolutely just openly wept. It was like a cascade. I said, I'm terribly sorry. I know this is really hard, but, you know, it is something we have to do. And she said, no, I'm weeping with tears of joy. I've been sitting here for 30 years hoping somebody would tell me to go.
Wow.
True story.
Yeah.
I was gobsmacked.
Yeah, like,
and, it would explain why she was incredibly nasty and gossipy, and she was really poison.
And yeah, isn't it interesting?
But nobody had said, hey, go.
It never,
it's not working here. Go somewhere else. And it was one of the most extraordinary discussions I've ever had. And unfortunately, or fortunately, in my life, I've actually had to have many, 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 many of those discussions. And the amount of people who can't have those discussions, who are CEOs, who are leaders, who won't sit down and look somebody in the eye and say, you know that I know that you know you shouldn't be here.
Yes.
And we're going to have to work this through. It's not personal, but, you know, we're going to have to fix this. So there are various ways of doing it and calmly taking people through. Now, I've released a lot of people to industry. I see them around the streets in Adelaide. I see a lot of them. Most of them look at me without rancor because they understood that they had to go. And in fact, most of them have gone to things that they're happier about.
Absolutely.
But it created an organisation that could fly, that could do double-digit compound growth, that could get new clients, that could embrace technology, and that had a culture that was a winning culture that people felt good about. But also it was a very, you know, if you're that open with people, it's also a very good people culture.
It's nice, clear.
Yeah, it's clear.
Yeah,
that's right.
No, it is good. Okay, well, just as we wind this little chat up, I'm just going to ask you for two key takeaways for all professionals, two things, you know, little gems of wisdom that you think, I wish someone had told me that.
Okay, the first gem is that I've worked with some of the most amazingly bright, technically expertise-driven people, and they are lousy communicators. If I sat there in a auditorium, if I sat there, as you have, Marina, in boardrooms, and watched these people try to communicate, it's woeful.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the best people in the world lose credibility because they've never learned to communicate. They've never learned to stand up in a boardroom or an auditorium.
Even in a team.
Or even in a team meeting. Yep. And be credible and be clear and be passionate about what they're doing and get that influence.
Mm.
People are terrible at it. And I said at a graduation of one of our universities, if you're the 2% who are brilliant at that, your career is going to take off because it's such a needed ability.
Mm.
And it's all about, once again, ability to stand up without being rejected. So fear of public speaking, rejection go hand in hand. You've got to overcome that. And I've offered to train people and I've got them there. You don't have to be brilliant. You don't have to be an extrovert. You can be very good at it. It's a learned skill, point number one. Point number two is that whole ability to, as you said, question the status quo.
Mm.
To actually say, do we really have to do it this way? Just because we've done it this way, really, almost, depending on how long that is, means by definition we're not doing it right. Because, as you know, in the age of disruption that we're in now, things are moving so quickly. If you can't constantly, almost weekly, monthly, question what you're doing now and how you're doing it, you're missing opportunities.
I think a lot of people are still living in the world that questioning means one must act. That's not. It's a separate activity.
Yes,
that
indeed.
The capacity to question is such an important part of leadership.
It sure is.
So, thank you very much. Now, just before we let you go, I'm going to ask you four really quick questions. Just four ones.
Yep.
Don't think about the answers too much.
Yep, that's right. All I'll be spontaneous, I promise.
All right. Favourite food? Happy spontaneous.
Bananas.
Bananas?
Well, I mean,
banana lollies or
fruit,
banana?
Probably, no,
fruit.
Real bananas. No,
real bananas.
No, favourite food, seafood.
Seafood?
Of every kind.
Okay. Yep. All right. Seafood. First pet you ever owned?
A vicious Siamese cat.
Vicious. What's the cat's name?
It was Riker.
Riker, of course it was.
Should have been Ripper.
But, Riker, Riker, like the prison.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. First car you ever owned?
A beaten-up Volkswagen Beetle.
Oh, that's a bit funky.
Oh, yeah.
What colour?
Turquoise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did it have a name?
With a sunroof.
Did I have a foxtail?
No foxtail. No fluffy dice.
Oh,
it was pretty cool, though.
Very good. And if you weren't doing this job, what would be your favouritest job in the whole world to do?
What I hope to do next, which is to do a lot of writing and speaking and maybe produce an interesting sci-fi musical and maybe do some recording and get a few interesting songs out there.
Fantastic. All right, we'll stay tuned for that. Thank you very much, Nigel McBride, for spending some time here. I'm sure all the 60 Mockers and the MCBI crew will appreciate your insight, so thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening in today. We look forward to you joining us next time.